Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to the Fandom Files, a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zachrin, the features editor here at Sci-Fi Wire, and I'm joined by my good pal and co-host, Emily Gaudette, who is an editor at Contently. Emily, what's up?
Hey, Jordan.
What's up?
Nothing. How's it going?
Cool. It's okay. It was like a Tuesday after a holiday weekend.
So that's good or bad?
I don't know. Life happens, man. You know, you got to roll with the punches.
All right. Wow. That's really foreboding. What is the geekiest thing you did this week?
This week I was at a beach house with a bunch of my friends and we played like a series of increasingly complicated board games.
Did you go on the beach?
Yeah, we did. Okay. It rained one day.
All right.
So that day it was like every next person to whip out their game that they were like, I wanted to try this out. It was like the rules got crazier and crazier.
Did people know to bring games or was everyone kind of just like tentatively pulling out board games they secretly brought?
No, they're all lawyers.
Well, they love board games lawyers.
Well, they love like logic and they love like thinking their way to the end of something. So by the end of the night, I was like, I had said a few times, I am unbeatable at Taboo. Like I'm a savant at Taboo.
All right.
And everyone was like, well, let's see. And I just fucking toasted all of them.
Were they upset?
No, they were like, oh, it came true, the Man. Prophecy. What's the geekiest thing you did?
That sounds so rowdy. Like, oh my God.
It was pretty rowdy.
Like, I cannot believe.
16 people?
That is insane.
And
you guys, well, did they call the police on you guys?
No, but that happened last year, actually.
Not the board games?
Not during the board game segment. It was because we hosted a formal. We had like, a black tie kegger and everyone had to bring formal wear.
And the people called the cops because it was so stupid.
It was
like arrest these people for being assholes.
So lame. Yeah, we don't know why.
Now we will bring on the master of bad movies from Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Riff Tracks, Kevin Murphy. Thanks so much for being here.
I am delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being... Well, I just said thank you. I already said thank you.
Sorry.
We should go back okay. in the circle.
We could go into an endless thanking loop, yeah.
I am so grateful.
A black hole opened up of gratitude.
Well, thanks for doing this. Why did I do that again? All right, here we go. Emily. We're both big... I knew it is. I think we're both big fans.
Yeah,
so
we're both, like, nervous.
Yeah.
Oh, don't. I'm really sort of a jerk, so I'll make this easy for you.
Oh, all right, good.
We love hating our guests.
Yeah.
It makes us feel better.
That's the best episode.
Yeah. So you are here to, you're here to talk about movies and bad movies and all that. You guys have a live show coming up, and that was the occasion. Tell us about that, first and foremost.
We do. We are going to be riffing the classic Mystery Science Theater episode movie, Space Mutiny, which... is one of the favorites of our fans from Mystery Science Theater, and since it's a whole new generation out there, all you millennials are out there wrecking everything.
Yeah,
and
the worst.
So it was a good time to revisit this movie because it's just so much fun as a riff. It's like the ideal movie for what we do because it's so earnest and so dumb at the same time. That it makes our job easy because so many of the scenes in the film set themselves up for us so easily. It's a delight to do. And our live show is going to be on, I want to make sure I get that date right, it's Thursday, June 14th. You see, I already blew it.
April 14th. April. You go back in time.
Thursday, June 14th, Riff Tracks Live nationwide. You can probably find it at one of your local theaters. We record it in Nashville. We perform it live in Nashville and record it.
Sweet.
But it beams out live to about 700 theaters nationwide.
That's awesome.
It is a really fun night of silliness.
When is the last time you saw this movie?
Before we decided to do it again, I had been checking in on it off and on just because I have some favorite scenes in there. So you see clips on the web of our old show doing it, mm-hmm. and just people like the film on its own. There's a lot of people who just just delight in it, you know, to maybe to rip on their own or just to have like a cult bad movie night. We'll put this thing on, and it's perfect for that. And so I hadn't really watched the whole thing until we decided to do it again. And now I am intimately familiar with it one more time.
So you're riffing on the Mystery Science Theater version?
No, no.
I was like, that's insane. You're riffing on yourself? Okay.
That would be too meta, yeah. Even for us. Yeah. No, but one of the fun things is because Mystery Science Theater was... could only be a certain length. We had to cut the movies down. The show was, 90 minutes long, and we had to cut the movies down and from feature length down to, in order to fit in the commercials, the movies were often, 65, 70 minutes long.
Mm.
So there are a lot of scenes that we weren't able to riff in the Mystery Science Theater version that we'll be able to do on the stage version.
A lot of important plot points. Really?
A lot of people getting killed and falling off of railings.
Well, I'm relieved. That's good. I'm glad that's in it.
So, you know what? So obviously, you guys have been doing riff tracks for a long time now. It's funny, yeah. Mystery Science Theater you got famous for, but you've been doing riff tracks almost as long as you did Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, at this point, I'm humbled to say we've been at it longer than I was, at least for Mystery Science Theater.
Wow.
I mean, MST has a new life right now, but I was involved in every episode of. Mystery Science Theater when it first came out. So this is kind of odd to have sort of surpassed. I feel like I'm older than my dad now.
That's so. I mean, obviously the riff tracks thing, it's interesting because you guys originally couldn't get the rights to the movies, but you've been able to do that more and more, especially with some of the really, really bad clunkers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's fun to do. I mean, we've had a chance to do some real gems because we, you know, thanks to technology, people could download our commentary tracks as an MP3, mm-hmm. and we have instructions on how to sync it up so that you can actually just roll your own at home. And so that's enabled us to do, Ben Affleck's Daredevil, which is one of my
yes.
favorites.
Same.
And Twilight, which was, that was just like sweet candy for us, I got to tell you.
And Forrest Gump, right? Your favorite.
Oh.
Your favorite film.
Oh man. Don't even get me going, please.
When you see that on TV, what do you do? Do you riff out loud when you see it on TV?
Forrest Gump?
Yeah.
I turn it off.
Oh, it's that kind of hatred.
He hates that movie. It's
a real genuine abject hate. It was, when I wrote my book, A Year at the Movies, I had ended up having to watch it on planes 3 or 4 times because there was nothing else on.
Jesus.
And so I had already hated it, but then I grew this real seething resentment for the fact that it ever existed. And it almost knocks down my respect for Tom.
Can't remember his name.
Almost.
Who?
That's like Emily's favorite person in the world.
Well, I mean, he's America's right. dad. It's everybody's favorite
he
person.
He is. He is the Jimmy Stewart of his time.
Absolutely. And I love Jimmy Stewart, too.
We were saying, like, after, you know, all these horrible things are coming out about actors, and if anything comes out about Tom Hanks,
that's like,
devastating.
Come on.
It really does seem that way, you know, that, he's been a family man. I mean, you know, you think about it, but you never know. But, you know, you hear these stories of he and Spielberg would, when they do a show, they would bring their families, on a location with them and, you know, hire tutors that they, you know, have one tutor for all their kids and that they actually, you know, like go to each other's houses and have barbecues. And, so that's encouraging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's good to hear that.
Maybe they won't fall off of their pedestals.
You know, you've been doing this for like obviously a while now, and there's a lot of people that you riff on that are no longer with us because they made really bad movies in like the 40s and 50s. But you know, there's people that, you know, who are still working today, and I'm wondering, what has that experience been like now that you've been doing it for so long? You've had live people, you've had like Starship Troopers, you did it with them in the studio, but what was it? Have you come face to face with people that you riffed on?
There was a movie we did called Time Chasers, which was done in West Rutland, Vermont, and was really dumb. Dave and Giancola is this guy who created a little cottage film industry up there in Vermont, and he does, you know, these, you know, dumb, cheap action films.
Cool.
And, it's really fun for us. And when we decided to do it live on stage, the whole cast came.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it gets a little, they wanted to meet us before and have pictures, and And we were saying, like, you know, I don't know, because when we should probably meet you before. That's better, because if we meet you after, you may not like us as much as you did before. At that end, you know, Kim Cattrall is still a pal, and you know, she and Trace ended up having a friendship out of that, even though we, you know, we were kind of merciless for on her when we did the movie City Limits. But, you know, actors take these things in stride if they're real professionals, and that's sort of cool.
Have you ever spoken with Graydon Clark?
No, I don't think I should. I don't think he'd return my calls, and if he did, I don't know if I'd want to hear what he has to say.
I watched Dark Future. Your riff on Dark Future last night, and that was really something.
Oh yeah. Well, and my problem with Graydon Clark is he seems to be a misogynist. He's got this real, you know, the things that we end up sometimes we do edit things out for time and for content when it's just like so overtly awful that we really feel like we need to do it, because otherwise we just can't do the film. And his films tend to, as a body of work, they seem to, you know, they go that creepy way that makes me uncomfortable. And so we're always very careful when we do his stuff. We go for the stuff that's less, you know, on the sleazy side and more on the science fiction side, and Dark Future was one of those.
A lot of barrels.
A lot of flaming barrels.
Yeah, yes. That's true. Do you have, like, criteria? Like you said, you try to avoid the misogynist stuff, like you said, but what makes a perfect Riff Trax movie?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why Space Mutiny is a perfect movie. It's fun to watch, just to look at. I mean, it's shot well enough that it's easy to look at, and the soundtrack is good enough that it's easy to watch. Or to hear. But also that, you know, if someone attempted to make a really adventuresome science fiction movie about some deep, try to put in some deep subjects and themes and interesting subplots, and they just failed completely. But they really tried hard, and that's the earnestness of what folks do in order to try to tell a good story that they ultimately can't, because they're just not really good at making movies. I think those make the best riffs for us, because there's something really almost naive about it. It was Trace long ago said that if you're a Marx Brothers fan, you'll get this immediately, that the movies we do are our Margaret Dumont. They're definitely our straight man or straight woman.
Yeah.
And the more sincere they are, the better it is for us, because we can just poke a lot of fun at them. But James Wan films like Birdemic are that way.
Love Birdemic, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. That's an interesting question, because I was watching Sharknado recently, and I realized...
A sci-fi movie?
That's not... Oh.
No, keep going. It's terrible.
It's not earnestly made. Like it's a little tongue-in-cheek, so for me... Yeah. It took some of the funny, like, punch of it out, because I was like, oh, this isn't a joke that I'm having. I'm being given this. Like,
It's been challenging for us to do those movies, and we've met those guys from Asylum, and really nice guys, and they know exactly what they're doing and how to go about it.
Yeah.
And there's something, I think the reason that we can approach it is that they seem to hire people and limit their resources and hire, like, you know, at the bottom of the farm team level in order to make sure that the films are going to be as dumb as they are.
I think that, like, Ian Ziering and Tara Reid, but especially Ian Ziering, really took it seriously. Like, the filmmakers didn't take it seriously, but the actors did.
That's
which
right.
makes it even worse. Like,
that's interesting.
Which makes it sad in a way.
Yeah, but that's...
Poor John Hurd. You know, one of the things you talk about, you know, we've been doing this for a long time, and we worry that the worst film the person does is going to be their last film.
Yeah.
You know, like Peter Falk did Corky Romano and then died soon afterwards.
Are you know, too related?
That's not a good legacy to go out on, I tell you. And John Hurd, who was in Sharknado, I was worried that would be his last film. And that he'd croak after that. Luckily, he has not.
I feel like actors should maybe hold on, like, one good one and not get it released until after, like, their death.
Yeah, that's true.
They're on their deathbed, they can get that last one released.
You know, do a really good indie and just keep it in your pocket until you die.
Yeah.
You finance it yourself, and it's your insurance film.
Right, yes, yeah.
That's great.
So, even if you do some piece of crap, you can go out on a high note.
Yeah.
This is brilliant. You should be an agent. You guys should start an agency.
Wow, man. Let's do it.
Don't tease us with more projects.
Look, we would, but podcasting is very lucrative. So.
Yeah.
You're rolling in that rich podcast money there.
Oh, my God. Yeah. The money's incredible.
So let me ask, have the Riff Tracks guys ever disagreed strongly on if a film was bad or worth riffing on?
Well, we all have our sort of guilty pleasures and our favorites, but, you know, whether a film is bad or not, I don't think we've ever disagreed on that. I mean, you know, with films that we actually like, that we go out and see, we've had disagreements about those things, and they make for very lively conversations and debates. But as far as films that we consider for Riff Tracks, I don't think that happens very often. I mean, we often disagree on, this film is too bad for us to do. It's going to be too boring, you know, too repetitive, too plain for us to do. And we all tend to like different quirks within that, you know. Our young writers like Connor Mostelka and Sean Thomason, who are brilliant writers, and they tend to like stuff that's weirder than I think we're used to. It was Connor, I think, that directed us to the movie Roller Gator,
which sounds like
I can't stand to watch that film. It is so, so bad. Joe Estevez is in it, and no one else that you'll ever remember.
Not even
Emilio? I think I remember Joe Estevez.
Joe Estevez is Emilio Estevez's uncle.
Oh,
he's Martin Sheen's brother.
If that's the star of the movie.
He's sort of a coattail hanger for Martin Sheen, and he's just been a B-movie guy, and he's just accepted that. And but even, you know, for B-movies, wow. See Roller Gator. See what I mean. Tell me if you disagree.
I'm looking up images right now, and I'm blown away. I can't believe this is real. What?
It's remarkable that you've seen, you know, I try to watch like 3 or 4 movies a week, given what my job is, you know, trying to mix some TV in there. And number of movies you say you've seen per week since you started doing this?
Mm. Oh, God. Well, I've recently been sort of put in charge of acquisitions. And so that's ramped up, because what I do is I pre-screen the movies that I think will be that we think will be candidates for Riff Tracks.
Wow.
And then the ones that I filter out, I present to the whole group, and then we decide whether we want to do those or not. And the ratio is held true. For every title that we do on Riff Tracks, like it was with MST, I would say the average is I have to watch 20 movies I reject.
Wow.
Do you watch the whole thing, or are you like, do you know within like 20 minutes?
If the first 10 minutes haven't grabbed me, then I start skimming.
Okay.
And then I know within, I mean, I won't spend too much time. And thank goodness for programs like VLC, where you can double speed the thing and zip through it real fast or skip really fast, because that's very helpful. So it is, it's a real, genuine, rigorous audition process.
Yeah.
And you know, Frank Conniff used to do it when we were at Mystery Science Theater for a long time, and he loved it. I mean, he could sit through the worst dreck you've ever seen and come out smiling at the end of the day. I think part of it was that he was sober, and so he had learned, you know, to live a day at a time and to take what comes at him, and maybe that's helpful.
He just appreciated being alive.
Yeah,
well, exactly. So I get to sit in a room and eat snacks and watch shitty movies all day. So, you know, my life is pretty good.
That's a good way to look
Hard
at
to
it.
Argue with.
Yeah. So
Frank has a great outlook on life. He's one of my favorite people, because I told him when we did our reunion show a couple years ago, man, you have not aged in 25 years. And he said, that's because I was already older than you when I was younger than you.
he got his living done early.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
he did.
What would you say is the worst movie you've seen lately or ever? Like the one beyond Forrest Gump, you know, the worst thing you've seen.
Oh, you know, I'm not a fan of the whole torture porn genre.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's one movie in general that I've seen there, but Hostel was just, you know, those things leave me cold. Mm. My pal Jonah Rodriguez has a much higher tolerance for that stuff, but I haven't sat down and had the conversation with him I think he's less to the torture porn than he is to like the real, just like classic grisly old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rob Zombie is maybe his high water mark, but I'm not sure.
Cool.
But that stuff, yeah, that stuff leaves me cold just as a genre. I had to, for a while, I was auditioning the films at Mystery Science Theater, and I came across this film called Demon Rug Suckers from Mars, I think was the name. And it stuck with me for a long time. It sort of haunted me, this huge, chubby, bearded white guy makes graphic love to a vacuum cleaner.
Jeez.
In the movie.
Boy.
So, yeah. You, that's not an image you ever want to put into your head. It's bad enough to say it.
Well, you said graphic.
Please, I urge you, don't look at this film.
So repeat the title for us, please.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Graphic. So, like, we're talking, like, you see everything.
We're talking penetration.
My God.
Wow.
Yeah, with a vacuum cleaner.
It always, like, I know this is a cliche thing to say about bad or screwed up movies. Like, there, so many people had to be a part of doing that.
Like,
that's the thing.
Yeah. How did Tom Six, like, recruit all those people to be in Human Centipede? The first one.
I don't know.
Like, what was the casting call for that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one that, you know, I watched about a half an hour and said, I don't really need to do this in my life.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't need this. I don't need to remember this.
Exactly.
So I'll just shut it off right now.
Imagine if you're like the craft services person on Human Centipede, ugh, and you're just there and you're like, what am I looking at? You like, haven't read the script, you don't know.
Yeah, true. Yeah, as soon as someone, like, summarized that movie for me and I found out what it had, like, that it existed, I was bummed out for a full 24 hours. I was like, humans made this? Come on. Like,
and there's a lot of them, too.
Yeah, there's
it
three.
It is a low watermark. It's true. Yeah. It's a low point. You don't need to do these things, so why?
You know, one of my favorite bad movies is I love Godzilla. I'm a huge Godzilla fan. I know you guys did Godzilla 98, and I recently spoke with Dean Devlin, who wrote and produced it. I think he knows it's not a particularly good movie. But then there's those movies that everyone hated so much, and you look back on them, and you're like, maybe that wasn't so bad. I feel like that's...
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
So name one of those. I'd be interested to know what would be one of those.
You know, I loved this from the moment it came out, and I was in... the vast minority about this. R.I.P.D. Do you remember that? With Ryan Reynolds?
No.
And who was
you
it?
Don't have to remember it.
R.I.P.D. is Rest in Peace Department. Rest in Peace Department, I guess?
In Police Department?
So basically, they play dead guys who aren't dead, but they're dead and they're spirits, but they're cops, and they fight like ghouls and haunted people. And it was definitely made, I don't know how it happened, but it looked like the visual effects, like Kevin Bacon is the bad guy in this, and when he turns into the bad guy, it looks like claymation. It's so visually bad. But there's something about it that was so stupid that I just loved the movie, and I wrote about it when I was at BuzzFeed. And I mean, this movie got pilloried. This was like Ryan Reynolds before he became Deadpool. This was like a real low part of his career.
Yeah.
And the writer of the movie like emailed me being like, thank you. You saw what we were going for.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that's nice. I mean, you know, yeah. And Ryan Reynolds, I think I've always sort of enjoyed him, even, you know, he could have gone that dangerous path, you know, of matinee idol and decided not to, which is good. And I think Green Lantern taught him a lesson or two, gave him a good spanking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Have you watched a lot of like the, did you watch Batman vs Superman? Did you watch Justice League?
Well, you know, that was one of the riffs we did, one of the MP3 riffs that's available. Here's the thing. Bill, Mike, and I have reached a fatigue factor on the big, chunky, blockbuster superhero.
Sure. Yeah.
Endless 7.5-hour movies that we can't do it alone, so we decided to make it sort of like a reunion riff, and we had Trace and Frank do a chunk of the movie, and Mary Jo Peel and Bridget Nelson do a chunk of the movie, and Matthew Elliott, our friend from England who does riffs for us, did a chunk of the movie, and Cole Stratton and Janet Varney, who run Sketchfest and have done many riffs on our site, they did a chunk of the movie. So it was this round robin riff, and it was the only way that we could get through the thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I'll have to go back and watch it now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It does get exhausting, these big, big blockbuster movies. It's difficult to
Well, even Gal Gadot could not save it. Even though every time she appears on the screen, she's like a breath of fresh air. It's like,
I know.
Finally, something is not oppressive or cynical or or creepy. Yeah.
Someone's alive. Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, I wanted to ask is, we want to ask all these questions. That's a stupid preface. you know, I have a question for once.
ask your question, then.
All
go
right,
ahead.
All right. God, I'm so sorry. I almost just forgot the question. All right, so... you know, film criticism has been democratized in a lot of ways, and people, you know, through Twitter and through reviews and especially YouTube can snark all day long. You know, there's videos like everything wrong with this movie or, you know, every single mistake in this and that movie. What do you make of that? Obviously, you guys have been riffing and snarking for all these years, and now there's these new millennials on the block.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't think that we are responsible for creating this practice. I think people were doing it before we ever did what we did. But maybe we gave people a little bit of license.
Mm-hmm.
But we've always done it in a spirit of having fun with it, which is, you know, if people are having fun with movies that they don't like, that's great. I mean, that's something you can put out there and, you know, put some positive. I'm all about positive energy in the social networks. No
that
matter how bad things are getting.
Yeah.
You know, you can be critical with positive energy. You can be funny with positive energy. You do not have to, you don't have to drop down in order to make yourself funny. You can do it with a little bit more of a positive attitude. So when people do that, I'm all for it. Just, you know, hating on something, I just don't find it interesting, or funny usually. It ends up being kind of boring. So, when people do that and they do it in a creative, interesting way, then yeah, I can hook into that. I can understand that, and I can empathize with it because of all the stuff, all the dreck I've had to watch. I understand, and you can dive in there and lean into it and have a lot of fun with it. And yeah, a lot of people on the internet have done that. I read an article today, and I won't be able to quote who it was, the source right now, but said something that really hit home with me is that. All of this, like, bad criticism and fake news and things that we're subjected to now came about when people decided to stop paying money for their magazines and the newspapers.
Mm.
And so they started getting their information and their criticism and things from sources that are maybe amateur in its very, or maybe just plain bad.
Sure.
And it's very difficult to... You don't have a gatekeeper. You don't know who actually has any credentials or experience or faculties in this, and it's not easy for you know, a reader to tell.
Mm-hmm.
I know. So it's, you know, I think that the social networks have not done enough to filter that out. That there's still all this stuff out there, and there are people who. I mean, you know, I know comment sections. I mean, a lot of the internet is just simply like a long string of comment sections. But people can just hang out a shingle and call yourself a film critic and put yourself out there and hate on whatever you want, and you know, and that's fine. But you know, I'm going to get bored pretty soon. And I always say to people, consider the source when you see those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Star Wars, of course, has engendered an entire world of critics.
Yes.
And supporters, you know, who fight with each other and hang on each other. And so it's been interesting to watch that happen because, frankly, you know, I actually went to Star Wars when I was in college. I'm that old, the first one. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was really fun to go see that movie. And I never thought of it as anything more serious to my world than Flash Gordon.
Right.
But for other people, it is.
Mm.
You know, it's like Tolkien. You know, some people have actually shaped their lives around what they read in J.R.R. Tolkien. Granted, I think that Tolkien created a universe that was much more deep and profound than the Star Wars universe has. And that's fine. We can agree to disagree on these things. But
Emily agrees
with
you.
I immediately put away Star Wars when I was so lucky. When I was in college, I got an invitation to a preview of it was just called a George Lucas Steven Spielberg co-production. Knew nothing more about it. It was the first cut of Raiders.
Whoa.
That's crazy.
In a tiny little theater in Madison, Wisconsin. I was going to college there.
What?
And because I was in the film school, I got this invite to a preview. And it was one of the most thrilling, one of the reasons that I wrote my book. It was one of the most thrilling experiences I've ever had in a movie theater. No one knew what the movie was about. We were all gathered, and it was this, aw shucks, everyone just hooked into it. You know, immediately, you know, when you see that scene at the beginning when you can't tell who it is running through the woods, he's being chased by he's actually outrunning his guides, and it's just, you know, from there it just took off, and like, totally, I'm in your hands. And for me, Rick, that the initial Raiders of the Lost Ark always be a better movie-going experience than Star Wars. Star Wars is fun. I knew where it was coming from. Raiders, I didn't know what to expect, and they took that old Quartermain sort of genre and updated it in a brilliant way, and that's, between the two, I'll always take Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Mm. Well, you know, it's funny, like, people with Star Wars, they need it to be sort of a religious event in a lot of ways. They need to imbue it with great meaning, and that's, I think some people didn't like Solo because it wasn't, I guess, significant enough. And that was the real complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Instead of just being fun.
Because it didn't start that way. It started as Flash Gordon.
Right.
Right.
It's a kid's movie.
So, yeah.
But, you know, it was, you know, you can kind of, well, that's not my place to talk about this because it's not my area of expertise.
Right.
And I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people about this.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so you went to school and you directed a lot of the Mystery Science Theaters and you were a puppeteer. Did you ever want to go and make as someone who's seen so many movies, go and make movies yourself?
You know, I thought about it a lot. I wrote a couple of treatments for screenplays, and I actually wrote a couple of screenplays. I've just seen and worked with so many directors that I know will always be better than I, that I sort of learned to do what I do best and found a way to do that. And so I'm very fortunate in that. Directing our silly little Cowtown puppet show was perfect. But anything more profound than that, I really never had much of an ambition to do it because I just, you know, I'd seen David Lean movies.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, yeah. Okay, you go ahead. You know, there's plenty of people out there much more qualified than I to do this sort of thing.
And that's a good way to look at it because you guys are the masters of what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
What has been your experience with super fans of your show? You know, that not just the movies you're riffing on, but you guys and the puppets too.
You know, we had a great experience recently on a lark. We wanted the four of us, Bill, Mike, and I, and our CEO, the guy who runs our company, David Martin. We went to London last year to seal the deal so that we could riff a Doctor Who episode. And then we wanted to go back to London because we had such a fun time. So we said, well, we'll do a couple live shows at the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square on the West End and went to London. And these people who were, you know, they never got, actually for a very short time, got Mystery Science Theater as any sort of TV series. But I was overwhelmed by the way they were fans, and they were great. It was really fun. I mean, these people, I never expected that sort of passion for what we do, for something that seemed to me so American and also so idiosyncratically American. But folks loved it, and it was great, and we had a great turnout, and we hung around with them after the show, and it was, again, it sort of refreshed my sort of appreciation for our fans. They're weird in the right ways, which makes me very, very happy.
You know, it's interesting that they brought back Mystery Science Theater 3000, I guess now a couple of years ago. You guys have been doing riff tracks. Was there any interest in going back to that? I know you guys cameoed, but how did that work out for you guys? Was the discussion?
Well, you know, it's been actually kind of really cool because I got to know Jonah, who's a great guy. I love him to pieces. And I got to know Baron a little bit and Hampton a little bit, and that's been really fun to meet these guys and see the energy that they bring to it. And it's sort of, there's a sort of satisfaction to think that, you know, these folks were fans of our show and now are in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that sort of passion and energy that, you know, they just jump at the chance to do it, that's, you know, that's very, very cool. I felt like I didn't really need or have a place in the new generation of this because I did plenty of it. As I said, I was involved in every episode from the time it was a pilot at KTMA in Minneapolis at the time we sold chunks of the set on eBay. So I'd had my time, and I think it's kind of cool. And I think Jonah's done a wonderful job and has kept his head about him with all of the weirdness that, you know, we had to deal with over the years with networks and with Uber fans who tend to be a little unkind sometimes. And he's done great. He's a real gentleman. And I think it's cool that they still want to do it and that people still want to see it. That's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean it's exciting, but like you guys have such a large library on Riff Tracks. Are there certain movies that you want to still do? Mm-hmm. You haven't done yet?
Oh man. I hesitate to bring up the list on my spreadsheet here.
Do it.
But we just finished a round of acquisition and finding a bunch of films that that we want to do, and oh man, there's some beauties on there. There's a I don't know if you're familiar with any of the K. Gordon Murray movies that we've done, like Santa Claus.
Oh, yeah.
Not Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, but the Santa Claus movie that is sort of badly dubbed in places and was actually produced in Mexico.
I am not. Wow.
Oh. Well, K. Gordon Murray invented a whole weird universe about him, and it mainly was taking other people's work and translating it into, or dubbing it into English, and then putting it out with new scenes cut in. And it's a very strange world that he created around him. And there's a film of his that I'm not going to name because we're hoping we can get it. That is just one of the weirdest things. right up there with the movie we did, Fun in Balloon Land, which was just covering. It seemed like a drunk woman was doing color commentation on a parade in Philadelphia that had a lot of giant balloons in it.
That's it? Oh, my yep. God.
That's it. 45 minutes long.
Ah.
So we found something even weirder than that, and that makes me excited.
Has it gotten hard or easier to get the rights to these things? I know at first you couldn't get really any of them, but...
Well, you know, we work really hard to do that so because, you know, nobody wants to get sued for what they do.
Sure,
and, and a lot of times, I think we've learned how to come at people and say, this is really positive for you because you're going to make money off of something that you haven't made money off of in a long time.
Yeah.
And it's going to be out there in public again. And we're going to, you know, have some fun with it, but we're not going to wreck it. It'll still exist in its original state. We don't break films.
Mm.
You know, people have been amenable to it. I mean, and if somebody gets a little, their price gets too high, we have to say, you know, we're a small company. We've got, 12 full-time employees, and so it's hard for us to do that. And one of the reasons we do a Kickstarter every year is that even with that, even when we do a film like Space Mutiny, we have to pay a surprising amount of money to get the rights to screen that thing nationwide.
All right, yeah,
and Krull, something. Which we're doing in August. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Krull.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But that's weird in a whole different way. It costs us a fortune just to get the rights to make fun of these things, and fair enough. I mean, somebody wants to get what they feel they deserve for it, and if we think it's worth it for us to do it, then we'll pay it. But that's why we have to do the Kickstarters, is so we can bankroll these things, and it's, you know, we know that our fans are going to want to watch these things, and so that's why it's worth it to do it.
You know, who do you pay the money to? Is it the distribution company? Is it the producer that owns the rights? Like, how does that work?
A complex network of all of those things.
Right.
You know, we generally pay it to one entity that then distributes it, however their contracts have been and however the movie was distributed.
They must sometimes get a Riff Tracks like bump in sales, right? I mean, I would think that someone would want to buy this insane movie if you guys are riffing on it.
I love the idea that that would happen. I don't know how often it happens, but I think with a movie like Time Chasers, which we did last year, maybe, you know, a movie that hasn't sold in a long time, and someone said, okay, I want to see what this looks like without the riffs.
Yeah, I mean, that's how The Room got huge, right? People were like, you got to see this, and they bring their friends.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Yeah, The Room was so much word of mouth. Yeah.
When you go to see a movie in theaters, when you watch it, do you just automatically start riffing in your head?
Nope.
No.
Ooh.
No, I don't go to see movies I don't want to see.
Okay.
I only go, if I'm going to spend the money to go to a movie theater, then I'll shut up and I immerse myself in the experience. It's a whole different experience watching a movie in a theater and watching a riff in a theater.
Well, so like, there's no instinct to just be like, what was the, you know, make fun
weird.
Of it? Yeah, even if you like the movie.
Well, you know, that's an excellent question, because if it turns out that a movie I thought was going to be really good actually sucks, then yeah, that riffing instinct kicks in.
Mm.
And but that doesn't happen very often, because I'm very selective these days on what I'm going to go see in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
Emily and I work in the field of watching movies and writing about them, but now Emily doesn't. She works in a different job.
Yeah.
So you were saying you just get to enjoy stuff.
Oh, yeah. For the first time in years, I get to just see movies because I want to. And it has totally changed my media diet.
Like, I bet that's so. What kind of a job gives you that opportunity?
Well, Jordan covers film for Sci-Fi and NBC, and we mm-hmm. met a few years ago covering movies for another like geeky website, and then I was at Newsweek covering movies. So it was like every single movie or episode of television I was taking in, I had to then regurgitate like content of some sort.
Yuck.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, partly it was like a dream job, and then partly it was like my viewing habits are not my own anymore.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, now I work in marketing, and I am like becoming someone who ingests art again in a pure way. It's kind of awesome.
Great. Yeah. Good for you. That's excellent. Yeah, yeah, it's really fun to just you know, sometimes even take a risk on a film that you've, or a style that you've never liked, and mm-hmm. see if it works for you. It was how I got to love Wong Kar-wai.
Yes.
I didn't know anything about Wong Kar-wai, and I went to see one of his films, and the first time I saw it, I didn't like it. But I said, there's something about this film I do like, but there's something I really don't like.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and saw it again, and you know, I said, wow, all of a sudden I'm using my critical faculties here, and I'm becoming a film lover again, and it was kind of great.
I love that. I can so relate to that. Also, I think yeah. that's the worth to me of little theaters that will play old films,
yeah.
like just running their own programming. I think that makes us more interesting, like you said, critical thinking people.
Oh, there are so few rep houses, and you guys in New York are very lucky that you have at least a couple of
yeah.
really excellent rep houses left.
Yeah, I love Metrograph. I'm there a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a couple. From the internet. People yeah. want to know a few things. One, are there plans to release more episodes of Riff Tracks on Amazon Prime? And if so, when?
Boy, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, it's been really nice that we can have our stuff out there on Amazon Prime. I'm not privy to that part of the biz, so I don't know when.
Uh-huh.
But we're definitely, we'd love to be able to do that. So look forward to that. We will make it happen.
What is Bill Corbett really like? What is he really like?
Oh, geez. I wish I could memorize that quote from a Manchurian Candidate, but Bill Corbett is the kindest, bravest, warmest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life.
How many licks?
One, two, three. I've never been able to get past three. So.
From the Tootsie Pop commercial. One, a two, a three.
Three.
I love doing that. And what sort of hobbies do you have? I guess I'm watching
sort?
Movies.
I got myself a fishing boat, and I live close to several really class A lakes, fishing lakes for largemouth and smallmouth bass and northern pike. And I go out in the summer and a fish.
Cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
I like that you take really on fun. A bit of an accent when you're talking about fishing.
I don't know what that accent is, because it should be a Minnesota accent. I say, I just take out the lung boat and I get myself some crappies, you know, and maybe some bluegills, because, you know, the wife, she fillets them for me. And boy, that's really good eating. You fry them things up, it's just like eating candy.
I feel safe with that,
Can
man.
Can we redo the interview and just have you do the voice the whole time? That would be tremendous. I love the Minnesota accent.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I just have, like, New Jersey and New York accents in my life. Like,
yeah,
it sounds like everyone in my family is, like, trying to commit a crime against each other.
Yeah. Do you say water?
No, I don't say water.
I do sometimes.
It's funny because I had a conversation with someone about Fargo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was up north and said, you know that whole Fargo thing, it's just all wrong. We don't sound nothing like that. You know? No, that's just golly, that's just taking it way too far, I think.
That's great.
That's perfect. Well, look, Kevin, how can people get in touch with you on the internet?
I'm at KW Murphy at Twitter, and that's where I do most of it. Because I cannot stand. What's it called again? That thing that the real rich guy owns?
Facebook?
Yes, thank you.
All of them.
I'd already forgotten about it.
Mm-hmm.
At KW Murphy is probably the best way to say hi to me. And I'm always lurking around all the Riff Track stuff, so anything there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, come up to me after a show if I'm available and say hi. I'll say hi.
Yeah.
Once again, what date is the Riff Track going live in theaters?
It is Thursday, June 14th. And you can go to rifftracks.com or featherevents.com and buy your tickets there at your local theater and come see us make fun of Space Mutiny live nationwide.
That sounds great.
I've always wanted to be involved in a Fathom event. I feel like that's the big leagues.
They're really fun. They're really fun.
Emily, how can people get in touch with you?
I am Emily G. Monster on Twitter.
And I am at Jordan Zachron on Twitter. We're also at Fandom Files Sci-Fi on Twitter. All those tweets. Give us good reviews on iTunes. Seriously,
yes,
if you've
please.
Made it this far, do us a favor.
If you're listening,
please.
5 stars.
Please. Kevin, thank you so much for being here. This was awesome.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, folks.